be like that. That was to say happy birthday to Yip Harburg, the guy who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And yeah, Travis Wernick, the outlaw dervish, is in the house, and he's brought some instruments, so we should have some live music here, and we'll be talking about the show coming up on Sunday with Eliyahu Sims. Wow, the one about a month or two ago at the Herb Company. It's going to be there this Sunday at 7:30. It was packed to the rafters, so get there early. They are really good. It was, the best energy show I've been to for a couple of years at least. It's fabulous, so make sure you go on Sunday to see Eliyahu Sims at the West County Herb Company. Travis, are you going to be playing as well on Sunday?
Yes, I will. I'll be doing the opening set, and I'll be playing some Native American flute, which I just did in Egypt as part of the Sound Healing Tour that I did there. And I'll be playing some solo didgeridoo and a couple of other treats.
Oh, fabulous. That will be a treat. So that will be a great show on Sunday. 7:30 it starts, but get there early because the last show with Eliyahu and Travis was beyond sold out. So it was good.
Amen to that.
Yeah. That's what we like to see in little old Occidental.
Oh, yeah.
So, welcome back, Travis.
Thank you.
You've had some adventures.
I have.
Worldly adventures, you might say.
Yes.
And, because, in fact, just at that last concert, that was just in the mid-January, just before the revolution in Egypt occurred.
Yes, that's true. In fact, it had just broken out. And at that moment in time, in late January, I didn't know whether I was going to be going to Egypt or not. And it was really fantastic and also quite tension producing those couple of weeks, because the group that I went with, Sedona Soul Adventures, out of Sedona, Arizona, none of us knew what to do. The trip organizer was watching the news and saying, let's wait and see what happens. You know, we've got 3 weeks, I think, at that point before the trip was planned. And the idea at that time was that a lot could happen in 3 weeks, and a lot did happen. Our trip was scheduled. It was canceled. It was rescheduled in May. And then the week before it was originally scheduled, we actually brought it back online, so to speak, and decided to go. So there were 23 of us that suddenly knew that we were going to Egypt.
Wow, that was history got in the way of your
yeah, and it was exciting.
Oh, that's great. And it's fantastic. You brought some instruments in, so maybe you want to just warm up a bit with something.
Sure, why
would you like to do that?
Yeah,
we chat some more about
Yeah, absolutely. I brought the didgeridoo that I had with me in Egypt that I was playing at the various sacred sites and inside the Great Pyramids and so on. This I like to call this didgeridoo centripetal force, because it's got this, this amazing centipede painting by an Aboriginal artist on the outside.
Oh, gorgeous, yeah.
So let me play a tune on this in D.
Yeah.
right. Oh, I love it. That's fabulous.
Thank you.
Wow, it's amazing how much sound comes out of just a hollow piece of wood.
It's true. Yeah, it is true.
I imagine in Australia, you know, where they came from, was it maybe used as a signaling device over long distances or anything like that?
Well, you've got me on that. I have no idea whether that was the case, but I do know that they're used for ceremony, for every type of ceremony. And that traditionally, when I was in Australia, one of my other travels, one of the things that I was told by Randy Graves, who used to be a really well-known and maybe still is didgeridooist, who's hails from San Diego, but he is living in Arnhem Land in Australia. As far as I know, the last time I talked to him was 3 years ago. And he was at that time, and I assume still is, working at a place called the Yirrkala Arts Center up in the Gove Peninsula, northeastern Australia, just south of the tropics, you know, the South Seas and whatnot. What he told me was that the didgeridoo is really like an accompaniment instrument in the tradition of the Aboriginal people, that it helps keep the rhythm, it creates a tone in ceremony, and it would go like underneath the voices. There's no such thing as an Aboriginal drum, that to my knowledge, what they use are clapsticks, which are made out of really heavy pieces of wood, heavier even than the didgeridoo, which is made out of a very heavy piece of wood. As well. So that's, you know, that's kind of what I know about it. And when I was there, there's a fellow named Jalu, and I didn't actually know who he was. I sort of went there with beginner's mind, so to speak, and didn't do any research really, and just kind of showed up and wanted to see what would happen. But Jalu, I call him like the Jimi Hendrix of the didgeridoo, because when I met him, he wears those reflective sunglasses.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently people, didgeridoo players, travel from all around the world to learn from him and to hang out with him. He'll take didgeridoo players out into the bush on like mini walkabouts with him. And unfortunately, I didn't get to do that when I was there, because he was headed off to play at a funeral ceremony, which sadly happens all too often up there.
Yeah, a big call for it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But wow, what an experience that would be to go out and do a didgeridoo walkabout.
Yeah, I'd like to. I need to go back sometime and contact Randy and see if he's still up there.
Mm-hmm. So we're speaking with Travis Wernett, the Outlaw Dervish, and he's come in the studio with some of his outrageous instruments. We're going to talk about, those instruments and Egypt and the world. Really, it's been a royal, and he's been in the eye of it for a little bit. So interesting energy to talk about. So how many were in your group?
Yeah, so the group that I traveled to Egypt with, there were 23 of us, and I believe there were 9 Canadians, and then the remainder were Americans. And so it was almost split right down the middle. And there were the three of us were leading the group, including Deborah Stengel Margrave, who leads Sedona Soul Adventures, and Keith Kavasich. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. My brother from another mother, who's also working with Sedona Soul Adventures, and who helped me this year doing the sound ceremonies and the meditations that we did in the sacred sites. Mm.
What was your itinerary then around once you got to Egypt? Where did you, let's just get a view of where you went first, and then we can go back and see sort of what happened. And
Sure. Okay, that sounds great. We started in Cairo, and I went the year before. I went in 2010 and 2011. And so we land in Cairo, and pretty much we followed the same itinerary this year as we did the previous year. Landing in Cairo was really wild because, you know, as you said before, we were pretty much the first group, if not the first group, to go in after the uprisings. And, of course, in our minds, all sorts of things are playing out. You know, I don't know exactly. We had some very interesting conversations, but I know what was going on in my mind. And, you know, it was like excitement mixed with, you know, some feeling of, I guess I could call it fear, you know, something, you know, something unexpected could happen or something surprising. I didn't really feel that like in my gut. Mm-hmm. And I tend to sort of, you know, operate by intuition in life. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, it was like, what are we going to find here? Kind of that sort of feeling.
Yeah, cars burning in the street.
And, right, you know, right.
You know, shots ringing out.
Right,
whatever. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And I found, actually, that there was, like, so much that I was carrying in my, like, mind in terms of the enculturation that would happen for an American person, you know, with the media over many, many, many years, right, painting these images of cars blowing up on the street and, you know, wild, right, like, Molotov cocktails being flung across the town square and et cetera, et cetera. And all of that stuff was in the news basically, you know, the 2 weeks before we left to go to Egypt. So, you know, I think it was on everybody's minds, but I think also everybody was pretty well trusting that we were going to be in good shape.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Cause you don't have any doubts.
Yeah.
In that situation.
Right. Right. Well, the Egyptian team, like who are now my friends, including, Mohammed Fayed and Abdullah Nasser and, our wonderful guide Rafat, I don't know his last name, but they were telling us at first, they were saying, don't come yet. Let us see what's going to happen. And then, like, when Mubarak stepped down, they basically said, okay, we're sussing it out. It looks really, really safe. Things are good here. Okay, come. Mm-hmm. And Deborah swears by their word. So, you know, she just told everybody, look, these Egyptian folks that are very close to me over the years and very dear to my heart have said, you know, it's all right. You guys come on over.
Yep.
So...
wow.
You know, somebody's word is bond. You can trust it.
But that's it. I mean, even amidst that, hospitality of the people, did that come through still?
That came through hugely. At first, it was a little bit like discombobulating being in Cairo. We got there later than we had the year before, and so it kind of felt like, you know, the city was kind of slowing down, and it also seemed very quiet, and naturally so, because 40% of the economy there is supported by tourism and travel, and so that was completely shut down.
Right.
We showed up, and we showed up at the hotel that we stayed at the last 2 years, and it was really quiet. They had some Egyptian guests, and they normally have like Egyptian weddings and whatnot, but it was really quiet, and it was different than it was the previous year. Proving the old axiom that the only thing that ever stays the same is change.
Right. Oh, yes.
But we were welcomed very, very awesomely by the Guardian Travel people who were there, Mohammed and Abdullah. And I hung out, even though I was jet-lagged. Actually, we all did. The three of us who were leading the group hung out and visited for a long while with Abdullah the night that we arrived and sort of got the scoop on, you know, the firsthand Egyptian scoop on what was happening there in Cairo.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll go back to Cairo in a bit.
Okay, sure.
But
sure.
Where did you... So, in your tour, where did you...
So the overall tour itinerary basically starts in Cairo and then goes south. And, like, there's lots of interesting places to check out near Cairo, and we did some of that, like, the first and maybe the second days. There's like the old step pyramid in Saqqara, and the great pyramids are there near Cairo, and there's a marvelous old reconstructed bark, basically one of the old Egyptian Nile River boats, and it's been reconstructed in a museum there near the Great Pyramids. So we spent some time checking that out, and the amazing thing about this is it's huge, it's beautiful, it's all made of wood. There's no nails, there's no metal, it's all fitted together, made out of wood. And they actually think, most of the folks who think about such things say that they don't believe that this ship was ever used for travel. It was purely a symbolic, metaphoric image for the ancient Egyptians, and they found them stored next to the Great Pyramids after a certain period of time, and they were packed very tightly in these airtight sort of storage containers, you know, underground. And you can still see those at the museum there if you go to check that out.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It was inside that air-conditioned, huge air-conditioned building with that.
Right.
Oh, phenomenal boat. I suppose it was for the when they symbolically went to the hereafter or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Boat, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I believe you could call it like the Egyptian night sea voyage of the afterlife.
Okay.
So after Cairo, then we went further south, and just kind of through the course of the trip, dotted along various sacred sites not too far off of the Nile River. And one of the places that we went to that was very special and incredible for me this year is Abydos. And basically this is the ancient mystery festival center that's associated with Osiris and Isis. And to get there, we had to travel on a bus for a great length of time and cross not the Nile River, but like one of the tributaries and a very large irrigation channel. And, you know, you sort of have the feeling that you're going out really into the deep desert there, the Western Desert, I believe it's called. And we did some ceremony there. All the sacred sites were incredible this year because there was nobody there. And these places are usually normally thronged with people, wall-to-wall people. So we showed up in Abydos, and immediately I had a feeling of the place that I didn't really get last year. And there are some incredible things that I could mention about Abydos. There's this place called the Osirian, which is behind the temple complex of Abydos. And the Osirian there are a couple of the Flower of Life images, which is basically kind of like an Egyptian mandala. And they found this place behind the other temple complex buried under sand, and they dug it out a bit, I believe. I believe that's the case. But what's interesting about it is that it's further down, like as if it's underground, and there's a source of water that comes from nobody knows where. Ooh. And it ebbs and flows, it rises and it falls, and they actually have catfish living in the water there, and everybody and their sister and their brother has an idea about, you know, what this place is or was and what it was used for. And so that's really significant to me because it's the center of the mystery rites, the mystery festivals, and so there's this you know, untoward mystery happening right there behind
water
the place.
And water is the ultimate mystery.
Yeah.
That's where that comes from. And, you know, it's just beautiful. Oh, lovely. So anyway, we'll talk about more about what happened there. Where else did you go?
So then,
where did you proceed?
Yeah, so then we proceeded. There's another amazing temple complex called Dendara. And that was the same day that we visited there. And one of the things that's unusual about that spot is that they still have some of the original reliefs with the original paint. And what they've done is they've done some work to clear off. There was some damage from soot. And what happened with a lot of the temples in Egypt is that the ancient Egyptians were there and then they weren't. And then folks like the Copts, the first Egyptian Christians, would find the temples and decide, hey, you know, this place is already built and looks pretty good. Let's just go in and, you know, knock some statues off the wall. And
remodel a bit.
Yeah, remodel a bit, you know, chisel some faces away and make the place look, you know, not as beautiful as it did when we got here and et cetera, et cetera. So basically then we just kept heading south and we headed for the Nile and get on a Nile cruise ship, which is kind of, in a sense, my favorite part because I like being on the water, you know, the last 2 years. Just really awesome to be able to just chill out on the upper deck of the cruise ship and just watch the land of Egypt as it floats by and the fisher people on the river and et cetera, et cetera. The places that we went to on the Nile included some like Horace Temples, Ed Fu, Kom Ombo, and then finally sort of culminating in the far south at Aswan. And the Nile cruise ship actually does go through the Aswan Dam, which was kind of great fun because we went into a lock.
Oh, yeah.
You go into a lock, you know, and you're down on one level, and they open the lock channel door, and the water comes in, and one just slowly rises up, and suddenly you're at the level of the next portion of the river, and time to journey on.
Go all the way back to Cairo on the...
I would like to do that sometime, but I don't know if... I think I was trying to pay attention this year as to whether there were actually boats going the opposite direction. The travel on the Nile, I reckon now, and definitely in the past, has always been the result of the current versus the winds, and the current and the wind go in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's not so pertinent these days because people don't sail up and down unless they want to in one of the old feluccas. But the cruise ships, I think, can go either direction. But what we do on this, what we did on this tour is we disembarked. And this year we caught a bus, and actually I wasn't present for this part of the trip because I caught a little cold and had to take it easy. But the folks on the tour went to Abu Simbel, which is the furthest southern temple in Egypt. And that one was reconstructed because they found it and it was underneath water.
Mm.
And it's quite incredible to look at and to realize that it was reconstructed because it's got some of the largest statue reliefs carved out of stone out of any of the temples in Egypt.
Wow.
So it must have been quite an undertaking.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, they say we think we're so big and powerful, but
advanced.
5,000 years ago, they were making incredible edifices that have survived 5,000 years.
And they're far more beautiful than most of the creations that we've, you know, come up with in the modern, fast-paced, desacralized culture.
Exactly. Well, this is Arnaldo, and I'm chatting with Travis Wernett, the Outlaw Dervish, and we're talking about his recent trip to Egypt. Well, great. Well, you mentioned the American flute. Would you like to play something so we can hear what it sounds like?
Absolutely. I'd love to. I've been playing a bit more of Native American flute lately because I was invited to do so in Egypt, and so I had a lot of wonderful experiences playing there, and I thought I'd bring it into the studio tonight.
Great, yeah, we'll talk about the actual experience, you know, things you did when you were there after this.
Great.
Fascinating.
So I'll call this tune Abydos.
Oh, that was just lovely.
Thank you.
Beautiful. It's like, could you describe the pipes? It looks like there's two coming at an angle. One looks like a drone or something.
Yeah, this is a drone flute. This is a Native American high spirits drone flute. And it was made by, well, there's a chap named Odell Borg who has a flute making business in, I believe it's New Mexico. And so he makes these really beautiful, lovely flutes. And this one on the left, I've got a drone flute. So it's just like, it's kind of like a mini didgeridoo. And connected on the right-hand side about at an angle. So it looks like a triangle if you're looking at the flute. And on the right-hand side, I've got the pentatonic scale of the Native American flute.
Mm. That's so effective, the two together like that.
I really much prefer it, like, for myself, because I'm sort of dabbling in playing this. I've been playing a little bit off and on throughout the years, but I've been playing a lot more lately. And for me, the sound of the drone flute, perhaps because I'm a didgeridooist, I don't know, but it really just kind of adds an extra texture and layer that sounds really intriguing to me.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Keep at it. I like it.
Oh, thank you.
Let's go back to Egypt. And so your tour wasn't merely sightseeing. You actually went to specific places and did specific ceremonies and rites. Could you tell us what that was like?
Sure. Yeah, basically several of the sites. The last 2 years, we've planned and executed. I don't know if executed is the best word for it.
Performed.
Carried out. Excuse me. Yeah, so in essence, what we did for 2 weeks is from place to place where we can, because not every location is really amenable to, depending on the guards there, depending on, because the Egypt Tourism Board, fronted by Zahi Hawass, he's the short, very energetic,
right.
charismatic guy that you see on all the specials. Apparently, he, particularly in regards to the didgeridoo, he does not want people playing didgeridoo or doing any kind of ceremonies in the sacred sites in Egypt. And he's, the thing with the didgeridoo apparently is that he's concerned that the vibration will knock something loose inside the temple complexes.
Ooh.
I think the temple complexes are tougher than that.
You'd think they've withstood a few earthquakes and lots of other stuff.
Yeah, thousands and thousands of yapping tourists, et cetera, et cetera.
Good point.
Yeah, but that's not really the question you asked me, is it?
Yeah. But it's good. It's good to get the background about how. Yeah.
Yeah. So
again, it's the sensitivity to local, culture is very important in the process.
You know? Right. Yeah. Particularly. Yeah. It feels that way on this trip. The people who have been doing this trip, they've been doing it for like 14, maybe 17 years, something in that neighborhood. So they have a really well established sense of what can be done and what can't be done, and how to communicate with people to try and make things possible. The thing that was really, really notable and incredible about this year's journey was that because it was so quiet, like for the first week, several of the sites that we went to, particularly I'm thinking right now of Saqqara, they were so quiet. There were so few people. We pulled into the parking lot and were, the only tour bus or two or three, and usually there's like 70 or so. And when we got to Saqqara, we suddenly had this brainstorm. We said, wow, this is incredible. Nobody's here. Why don't we do a ritual inside? Normally, we would do it outside. And doing it inside afforded certain sort of benefits, because when one is trying to play the Native American flute, for instance, in the wind will blow over these little air holes here and cancel out the sound.
Right.
So we decided to go for it inside the temple there, and it was extraordinarily beautiful.
Mm.
And so you know, we sort of think about the energy that we have perceived or that is known in the various sacred sites, and then plan the ceremonies or the meditations around that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the way that that we plan is knowing that we might only be able to go and do something for a very brief moment of time. We sort of plan for that and then go and do it and try to be very focused about it and then come away. But this year we just had a lot of space around it. And so we were able to do, comparatively, I've only gone the 2 years, but the year before, we weren't able to do the same length of ceremonies as we were this year.
Wow.
So in some of the ceremonies, we would play, myself and Keith this past year would play the flutes. And sometimes we might offer some various ideas, thoughts, reflections, or even specific directions about kind of where to go in one's imagination or one's heart. And we mix it up a bit, you know, playing, I'll play the didgeridoo in some of the, for instance, at Luxor Temple, which is a really cool, another one of my favorite spots. There's a back temple. It's a Sekhmet temple, and Sekhmet is the lion-headed one, the Egyptian goddess of anger, but also of reclamation of the heart's emotions. And basically what is said of Sekhmet is that at a time when the people began to forget the divine, they began to neglect Ra, the sun god, and forget about making offerings, and, hey, we can, you know, hey, this is cool, we can do this on our own. He said, well, this isn't working for me. I'm going to set Sekhmet upon the people. And so she comes out with her lion head and begins devouring people, and people are running and scared and, of course, you know, freaking out, and it gets to the point where Ra realizes, wow, this is getting a little bit out of hand. If I don't stop her, and how can I stop her? Humanity will perish. So he devises a plan to basically put some red dye into a batch of beer and spreads, well, during the course of the night, he pours beer, red-colored beer, upon the land. And in the morning, Sekhmet thinks, oh, this is the blood of the humans. I want to lap it up, and begins drinking it, and thereby passes out and forgets about her insurmountable rage against humanity, and all is well once again. And not bad, huh? And the other thing is, when Sekhmet is placated, she becomes Hathor, the goddess of beauty and music and creativity. So it's kind of one of these universal archetypical expressions of an aspect of the divine.
That yin and yang thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Have that, those two sides.
Yeah, exactly.
For creation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what spaces were you doing these in?
So at the Luxor Temple, there's a back room, and there's a Sekhmet statue. There's an old Sekhmet temple there. And basically this year, because of just kind of a series of set of circumstances that were unforeseeable, we were able to get into the room next to the Sekhmet room. Last year, 2010, we were in the Sekhmet room. This year, we were right next door. But it was interesting that we were right next door, and it felt like somehow perfect, like a lot of other things did on this journey, almost everything. And so we just decided to go for it. And it's really back away from like the traffic and in a back, it really is like a back area and quite a small room. Basically, we were only able to fit about, you know, 23 of us in there, and you know, fairly dark, no artificial lighting. And we did, it's one of my favorite spots, you know, we did a really powerful ritual there, releasing anger and, you know, feeling, allowing ourselves to feel the anger and get in touch with that and what that means to creating boundaries in life and so on and so forth.
Yeah, how was the energy in, say, a room like that? I mean, when you have that purpose, how was that feeling? That must be quite something when other people are joined with you as well.
Yeah, yeah, it can be very powerful, and I think some of the most powerful group experiences that I've had, and I've done quite a few group experiences of this kind, have happened in Egypt, and particularly this one, the Sekhmet ritual this year felt very powerful. Just it feels like something's happening, and for me, because I'm leading and I'm playing the music, I'm trying to kind of hold and create an imaginal container. So a lot of times if I tune in, I can kind of feel what's happening, but I'm kind of having to pay attention to holding the thing. So, but at the end, when I'm done playing, for instance, it was just really powerful. It was really powerful. It was really clear that there were several individuals that were going through some transformative experience as a result of our time there. And it just continued because there are some people who believe that the Nile, the energy centers on the Nile, where these sacred sites are built, correspond to the human chakra system.
Oh.
And if you kind of look at it, it's interesting. If you look at it on a map, you know, Cairo's at the top and then going all the way down to the south, you basically do get several intensely big, important temple complexes that would correspond to the seven chakras. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I felt more so this year than the previous year, I felt that was certainly the case. For instance, Abydos would fall in the realm of the heart chakra, and it just felt that way when we were there. It felt watery, it felt emotional, it felt, you know, like all of these things that are associated with the heart center.
Yeah, now Abydos, yeah, you definitely sound like that made quite an impression on you. Did you play the North American flute?
What we did there was we did Tibetan singing bowls. Yeah, and just a very kind of almost a sedate, very, very quiet, very spare, but nonetheless rich meditation. The thing that was remarkable to me in my awareness about it this year was that for me, just approaching the place, I was just sort of dwelling in a sort of rumination around mystery in general and water. And then we got there, and I had forgotten if I had learned the year before about the Osirion and the rising and falling water that nobody knows, where it's quite far from the river. So to have that amount of water there is really interesting.
Right.
The ceremony itself this year was fantastic, because we started and it was very quiet, and we spent some time like actually trying to find the right spot and trying to remember where we had done it the past year. And when we finally found our room with the help of Muhammad, thank you Muhammad, and our trusty guides, we all got quiet and we could hear the birds singing. And, you know, the birds singing inside this temple. And the way the light comes in a lot of the temples, they had an ancient version of, you know, in the desert, you don't really have to worry too much because you can put just a little aperture of the correct proportions in the wall and you're going to get light. And they were amazing technicians when it came to this. And so that was the light that was feeding in was all non-artificial light, just the spare light of the sunshine coming in. And as we began to play the bowls and lead the meditation, slowly the call to prayer began to float out from nearby, and it was kind of leaking in through the walls. So we were getting the call to prayer from the nearest mosque, and the singing for that is quite beautiful. I find that every time I hear the call to prayer, in fact, when I'm in Egypt, they do the morning call to prayer. And normally I'm not a morning person, but when I'm in Egypt, like the call to prayer just gets me up out of bed. And I it's almost like a cartoon. I start to almost like float up out of the bed and over to the nearest mosque, you know, following the sound waves of the beautiful voice.
Right. Oh, fabulous, yeah.
So we recorded this this particular ceremony, and what's interesting is that over the course of the experience, I didn't notice this firsthand, but other people did, the birds slowly quietened and just sort of peaced out, you know. They just sort of like, oh, wow, there's some people here, and they're making music. Let's listen to what they have to offer.
They're communicating.
Yeah. So it was like this really beautiful feeling of peace when we were done, because the call to prayer had finished and the birds were no longer singing and we were no longer doing our thing. And quite a profound silence fell over the space.
Very special. Giving shivers.
Yes.
Well, that's what's wonderful about the music you do. It really takes people away from all this craziness, I think. It really is a transportational type of thing that, you know, it really helps, I think.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful to hear, because as a matter of fact, it's kind of one of the reasons that I am... I just make music because I have to, because it's inside of me. But that's one of the thoughts that I often have, is that I would like to offer it in that way, and I do offer it in that way, in any way I can, actually. Yeah. And one of the... For me, one of the encouraging thoughts or ideas around difficult or troubling times is that the thing that has always saved us, and the thing I think that will always save us, or almost always, is the imagination. And music springs from the imagination, and it springs from the soul. And the soul is here to say, there is a way to make it across.
Exactly, exactly. Would like to play something else?
Sure. Yeah, let me get my shaker, and
okay,
I can play a bit of a more perhaps upbeat piece on didgeridoo.
Oh.
Different place after that now too.
Yeah. Now, was that one, you know, do you improvise or do you
Yeah, I do a lot of improv when I'm playing the didgeridoo, but I also have some written pieces. And basically what I do these days when I play the solo didgeridoo is I intersperse a lot of like different parts from different tunes in essence.
Oh, okay.
Sort of to keep it interesting for myself and And I think as my playing develops and transforms, I think what happens is I get to the stage where I want to put some different things together here and there. For instance, I've been sort of pushing myself lately to play with the shakers and some different percussion instruments while I'm playing the didgeridoo, just to kind of add another level of dynamic and make it interesting for myself and hopefully for folks who are listening.
Yeah, no, that's great. I like that idea. Mm. Say guitar, drums, shakers.
Yeah,
as long as you can do it. That's the main thing.
Yeah, I like playing the guitar and the didge at the same time. That's a lot of fun. It's nice to have the melody along with the didge. Mm. You can definitely look for more of that from me.
Okay.
Maybe not this Sunday, but soon.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll be watching.
All right. Great.
Well, now, you know, in Egypt, obviously, it was in total political turmoil when you went there. Can you give us some of your, impressions of what was happening to the people, the places, what was in the air there?
Sure. Yeah. Well, immediately when we arrived, I think it was probably at its sort of its high point. You know, we went, we drove past Tahrir Square, and there were still people gathered there. And basically, one of the things that we weren't sure about before we took the trip was they were talking about closing all of the sites because nobody was coming. And they, it was kind of like, let's close the government kind of thing. But what they had to do before they could let people come around was one of the things, they had the cleanup day, but it lasted for more than a day. So the museum there, which is right next to Tahrir Square, there was a slight amount of damage on the outside and whatnot, but they had that cleaned up before we got there. One of the striking things was seeing the building that had been burned, and I believe that was the police headquarters.
Yes, that was that big sort of building with a lot of small windows in it, right
exactly.
on the square, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yeah, and that was one that we would have seen a lot of images in the news and the media, and we saw it, post-burnout, and that sort of made it visceral, being there, because everything really was back to business as usual, so to speak, but the thing that the Egyptians kept saying, which I thought fit my impression, having been there twice, the friends of ours that were there kept saying, the sky has cleared, the air is cleaner, the sun is brighter. And this was the feeling. And, all sorts of amazing, unexpected things happened. People were shouting out to us as we were walking, down the street, "Welcome to Egypt, Obama, Obama," and just lovely. And, sometimes my mind would question, are they just playing with us or is it just one of those things? But no, it always felt like a genuine, very authentic, joyous welcome. And
that's what I found when I was there in 2003, really. It really is.
Yeah. Really glad to see somebody who could potentially be a new friend and is considered one immediately.
Right.
Yeah. We went to one of the places in Old Cairo where there's kind of a bazaar where people can wander through the back streets and do a little shopping, and there's some lovely cafes, shisha cafes right there. And we came up, there was a tunnel for crossing underneath a busy street, and we came up through the tunnel and we came out the other side, and the entire square, people started shouting and clapping and singing to us a welcome song in Arabic. And how good does that feel? I can't remember that ever having happened in my life anywhere.
Wow.
Before,
especially for Americans going somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a really incredible, poignant feeling, because all the times that I've traveled in the past, I've always felt, particularly during the Bush regime, it felt like, whoa, should I pretend like I'm from someplace else, take off an accent or something and not tell people that I was from the U.S. But this time, when people asked where I was from, I felt good about saying, you know, I'm from America. And they felt good about that, too.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. That's good news.
Yeah.
That's good news. Because, yeah, when I was there, it was just before the Iraq War broke out.
Right, and right.
It was amazing. There was 300 million Canadians.
Wow.
You know, just because everyone was saying they were Canadian rather than...
Right.
Because yeah. Suddenly got very overpopulated.
Yeah. The Canadian Travel Bureau was working overtime.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so there were things like this that happened in several various locations.
Were shops open, you know, things selling normally, that type of thing?
Yeah, for the most part. There were, according to our friends there, there were a couple shops that hadn't been opened yet. And part of that was, you know, if there's only one group of, you know, or maybe a couple of groups, things slowly opened over the first week that we were there, was my impression. Mm-hmm. And I had just some really interesting experiences at the hotel. There was an Egyptian man one night who approached me and just wanted to start a conversation and talk about where I was from. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I said I was from America, he looked shocked, you know.
Oh, well.
What are you doing here? I thought you were going to say England, Germany, you know. That was kind of the impression that I had. And he just got very excited. And one of the first questions he asked was, "Are you afraid?" And I said, "Now, no. Now that I'm here, I'm seeing people, I'm talking to people, I really don't feel..." And at that point, it was probably like 4 days into the trip, I didn't feel it anymore, really. I mean, there was still some kind of, you know, small idea of like, well, you know, anything can happen. But that's always the case in life.
Yeah.
Right.
Happen anyway, yeah.
Right, right. So, you know, that was really interesting to just engage with people and have people really surprised. And to Sedona Soul Adventures' credit, you know, the leader of the company and the leader of the tour, Deborah, just really, I think, does a fantastic job of organizing these trips. And part of what that entails, because it's a spiritual adventure, is her kind of tuning in and figuring out, you know, how are things going to work here at various points along the way. And I think she did a fantastic job of ascertaining that it was going to be safe. She's in love with Egypt, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I like traveling with her there. But to her credit, she brought a group of Americans and Canadians. And to the group's credit, too, it was a really good group. You know, the past 2 years I found, I mean, that's the only years that I've gone, but they were both really good groups. And the folks were all very enthusiastic about going. And, you know, it was an interesting, really interesting thing.
Beautiful. No, I mean, talk about exciting, being right there where when history was being made a whole country is being reworked.
Yeah.
Into, you know, we don't know what image it will be yet, but hopefully it will be a little better than what they have belabored under. Because such lovely people to, you know, to have lived under those conditions for so many years has just been criminal. And because it is a rich country in so many ways, and there's no reason for people to be in such poverty and you know, civil rights abuse. I just love it, purging that, and we'll see where it goes to, but you know, and that's it. And them seeing people come into the country must make them feel good that they're being trusted, you know, and that they're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And you know, the overall tone of people was very, very hopeful, very, very optimistic that things will get put back together in a good way. They voted in their version of a constitution a few weeks ago, and there will be general elections of some sort of a diplomatic nature next November, as I understand it. So this is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's moving, and it's good. Yeah. yeah, my daughter lived in Egypt for 5 years, and so she said, yeah, the judge who's sort of overseeing it, he's meant to be very well regarded.
Oh, good.
You know, he's not a government type of guy.
Okay.
You know, you have to stood up against them. So
yeah,
it seems like, you know, it can shift somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Fabulous, yeah. We'd I suppose I should... Oh, yeah, we've been running over here.
Uh-huh.
Would you like to play one more thing before we wrap it up? A pipe?
Yeah, let me play another thing for Native American flute.
That was so lovely. I can't just have just one.
Yeah, well, I have some more for you, my friend.
Okay.
This is a flute part that goes with one of my spoken word pieces that's on... my first solo record, Lanterns of Midnight, and the song is called Yearning to Come Be Feathers Again.
Thank you. What was that called, that track?
That's the original tune is called Yearning to Come Be Feathers Again.
Okay. Oh, that's a enigmatic title.
my poetic way of saying I'd like to fly again.
I have a feeling you will, Travis.
Amen to that, my friend.
Yeah, you got some great places to go, I think.
Yeah.
So, wow, what a great trip. What an amazing, thing for every part, for, the heart, for the eyes, for the senses. A very special time for you.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very grateful to have gone. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's so much crazy stuff going around the world. Just, obviously Libya, Tunisia, Yemen, Oman, Syria, Jordan. Somebody immolated himself yesterday.
Yeah.
Incredible things happening in the Middle East. There are amazing changes. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought just a couple of months ago, such things would be
like
happening
fire.
There.
Yeah, like a fire catching. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's it. In the Middle East, we always thought it was a very, there's these despotic rulers and people are very, but that really wasn't that things had changed, without people realizing the whole social media network thing has totally changed things around the world, apart from the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find it fascinating from kind of a mytho-poetic standpoint. It's like the soul is just breaking up, rising to the surface and breaking out and saying, we want change. Change will come now. And the interesting thing is, people are saying no to despotism, in a sense. And I think to a lot of minds and hearts, that's kind of the opposite of what's supposed to be happening in the Middle East. At this time, there's a lot of Yeah. There's a lot of thought and energy around, you know, what's happening on the planet at the moment. And this is wonderful for a variety of reasons. I know there's a lot of suffering, but to me, suffering is part of change. And just kind of, you know, it's one of the aspects, and grief is also one of the aspects that accompanies us when we go through deep change. And there's a really hopeful tone to a lot of it because of what is being stood up for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also the whole, you know, everyone bearing witness to it now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just done, you know, something we hear about 2 weeks later
in
the byline in a newspaper.
That's right.
It's right there as it happens now.
Yeah.
You know, that's huge.
It is really beautiful and huge. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So much happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I say it's good and bad. What can you say? But we try and hopefully ride the good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, ride that wave.
Yeah. And send our brothers and sisters who need some extra hope and prayers and spirit songs.
Well, thank you so much, Travis.
You're so welcome. Thank you, brother.
No, thank you. Thanks for coming in, and fascinating stories. And hopefully, we'll be able to hear some more from some of the other travels as we go.
As they say in Egypt, Insha'Allah, God willing.
Perfect, Insha'Allah.
Thank you, bro.
And the one Arabic word I remember and you use all the time, Shukran.
Afwan. Yes. Thank you. You're welcome. Very good, my friend. Take care.
Well, thank you, Travis.